Live in Mixtapes.
Some business I had to do, business of a strange kind. I taught English, you were French. We kissed on a bench. Your world so different to mine. Tell me what you see. Tell me what you see. Tell it back to me. Tell me what you see.
Hello, Lucas.
Hi, Christian.
Good morning. This is the first episode we're doing in English, normally in German.
Mm-hmm.
We do it in English because our guest we're having a Zoom meeting right now is a gentleman from Australia. He's living in Brisbane, Australia, and it's Robert Forster. We know his work, of course, very well, but maybe some of our listeners don't. So I just sum it up briefly before we start talking to him. Mm-hmm. Robert is a songwriter. He's active since the late 70s, I guess. At the beginning, he formed a band named the Go-Betweens. They were active in the 80s. Then the band had a hiatus in the 90s, and then they started again in the 2000s. Until they had to stop because of the untimely death of the other songwriter of this band, Go-Betweens, which was Grant McLennan. And then Robert started doing solo work, which he also did in the 90s. And the Go-Betweens, I would say, is a band, or also Robert's work is a band or an artist with some kind of cult following. They never reached superstardom, but if things would have went a bit different, they could have been something like REM or so. But they have a cult following, so it's a bit like the Velvet Underground, where people say that the first album wasn't sold that well, but everybody who bought this record or saw them live started a band. Mm-hmm. So that's a bit with the Go-Betweens and Robert's work. And yeah, so we're in Brisbane now. We have in 12 o'clock, so midday, and I guess in Brisbane it's 8 p.m. Is that right, Robert?
That's correct. Yes.
Anything you need to rectify from what I told just now about your work or your band?
No, I thought that was, Christian, I thought that was a very good summation. I thought that was very, very good. Very, very happy with that. Yeah, beautiful. Beautiful.
I read something about the Go-Betweens. You said you had the right songs, but it was the wrong time. What would be the right time of the Go-Betweens? Mainly the 60s?
Maybe the 60s, because I think in the 60s, people like Jim Morrison and John Lennon and, like, say, Grace Slick, from the Jefferson Airplane, they sort of became big stars, and they were very wild people. They were real, so I think that sort of didn't happen so much after the 60s. The everything sort of calmed down quite a lot. But I think the Go-Betweens are still of their time. And I actually think that we were successful. I think we came from a town where really no one was making albums. We were miles away from everywhere. I taught Grant to play the bass. Neither of us were great musicians. It was a band about ideas and dreams. And so the fact that we actually toured the world, the fact that we actually made 9 albums, and the fact that I'm talking to you tonight, and that to me is success. To me, I see it I also see it in a very positive way. The life of the Go-Betweens.
We're calling you from Vienna, and I think that Vienna is a town you maybe love, at least you like it. Austria is a country I think you like, and most of your touring you do in Australia and in Europe, and in Europe especially in the German-speaking world, right?
That's true. And that began right at the start of the Go Twins career, in like 1983 when we first started to tour in Germany, and then soon after come to Austria. The band was just we were embraced. People liked us right from the start, in these countries. It was a wonderful thing, like something that the band did at the beginning appealed to a German-speaking sensibility, and it's been the same all the way since. And I can't explain it. It's probably because, German-speaking audiences are very intelligent, and they like what they like, and I'm very happy about that.
You're also married to your wife is from Germany, and you also spent
Yes. Yeah.
considerable time in Germany. Do you right now still have a home in Germany, or are you only there when you're there? You're living for rent somewhere, or do you not live there at
Yeah.
all?
Yeah. When we used to go a lot, in the first 20 years of this century, we used to go quite a lot, and we'd stay with family, and we'd stay at Karen's house. The family is centered around a couple of towns in Niederbayern, like Regensburg, Geiselhöring, Straubing, and then Munich, of course. So the Karen's family is in that sort of corner of Germany. But Vienna and has always played a part in our lives as well, because Karen and I were married in 1990, and we had our honeymoon in Vienna. We got the train from Regensburg to Vienna, and we spent a couple of days there. It was beautiful.
I get the feeling that locations are very important for you. You're a person that seems to be interested in locations. Is it also
I
very
am.
important for you to visit different locations when you, for example, record an album or something like that?
It's I location is very important to me when where I record. As I wrote on the sleeve notes of the album of Strawberries, my latest album, the sleeve notes on the back. And to me, it's like a recording studio. To me, it's like with a film director with location. Like it's I'm I'm very much. That's really important to me, the way it is to a filmmaker as well. Do you know what I mean? Like where you make that film, what's the weather like, what's the architecture like, and that really affects where I record as well. But in general, I really see when I go on tour, and this has always been the case, going back to the 80s, was a chance to see countries and visit places. And so when I'm in Vienna, I'm only there for a very, very brief period of time. So if I can get around to even just something like Cafe Gold Egg, I feel something. I feel I'm in Vienna. Do you know what I mean? And that's important to me before I get back onto the bus, and then we go down the Autobahn. I need to connect to and see things. I like walking the streets in cities. Vienna's a lovely place to walk around. Beautiful city to walk around.
Do you connect your albums with some your general state of being when you recorded this album? Because you have this new album, Strawberries, and when I heard it, I had the feeling that you're in a pretty good place right now. So that currently you're in a state where you're happy, and you're
I think that's that's what the songs felt like to me, and also the sound. I knew what the Swedish musicians were like, and I wanted to make an album maybe that didn't sound like anything that, you know, that was different to what I'd done before. And I thought I'd go to Stockholm and work with the musicians there. And it's like an attractive album. It's a lot more. Yeah, there's a beauty to it.
Someone ate all the strawberries.
Someone could have been me.
They tasted out of the ordinary.
What can ordinary be?
What can ordinary be?
I once owned a Brett Whiteley.
As it gazed down on your life,
as it gazed down on my life.
Miracle days of happiness,
joyful moments of bliss.
Miracle days of togetherness, sealed with your tender kiss.
If somebody would ask me, who does not know you and your work, what this is all about, I would say that some kind of leitmotif would be memories, remembering, and such
yeah.
stuff. And I had that's the first thing which I associate with your work. And I think this kind of remembering, it's not so in the center that much, or maybe I did not find many memories in this new record. But maybe that's just my impression.
I mean, that's always, I think perhaps, you know, like there's more with dealing with memory in the past when I'm writing more about myself or things that are close around me, where these songs, I think memory's always been important to me because I think it's something that is always with me. You know, like, it's you live in the past, you live in the present, and you live in the future in a way, all in one thing. And I don't know when I just started to become more interested in the past. It was probably sometime in the late 80s and the 90s mainly when I started to get older, I think that was a big thing. You know, I think that's when memory starts to, because up until about the age of 30, you're not really thinking about the past. You know, like up until 30, everything is now. And then suddenly you get a little bit into your early 30s. Well, that's what happened with me. And I started to look back. And for any kind of artist, looking back, there's a lot of interesting things to write about when you start to look back.
If the cliffs were any closer, the water wasn't so bad. I'd dive for your memory on the rocks and the sand. I'd die for you. Like a bird I'd descend. Deep down I'm lonely, and I miss my friend. When I hear you say that we stood no chance, I'll die for your memory we stood that chance.
And was this some kind of decision so that you thought and say, okay, this is something with which I can work? I mean, you wrote in your book that you found out that it's best for you to write about yourself. And maybe,
yes.
Was there some point in your songwriting where you said, okay, writing about memories, writing about the past, this is something which works for me, which produces songs, lyrics, or is this something which came naturally?
I think like a big turning point for me was when Grant McLennan wrote a song called Kathleen Kane, and which is on an album of ours called Before Hollywood, which came out in 1983. And like that, he was the one that showed me, you know, he was the one, he started to write about, you know, the schoolboy coming home and all of these sort of, and he'd never written a song like that before. And suddenly I started to realize that the past was also subject matter. It's almost, you know, like I was so much in the present. I was so much just looking around me, and Grant suddenly went backwards and he looked back. But it wasn't nostalgic. It was just sort of, he somehow made the past come in and be with his lyrics. And that was when I really started to think about it. Because no one had really done that before. You know, like people like David Bowie or Dylan, they hadn't really done much of going back to their childhood. You know, Bob Dylan's got no songs about his childhood, really. But Grant did that. And so I think that was the start. But it still took me a couple of years till I started to, around the time of maybe 16 Lovers Lane or Danger in the Past. I also read Proust. I mean, that's what I did when I was in, Bavaria, when I first moved to Bavaria, with Karen in 1989. I put it off. I started to read Marcel Proust, Remembrance of Things Past, and so that was a window too.
Is it called in English Remembering the Things Past? Is this the English title of this?
Yeah, it's called Remembrance of Things Past.
I think in German, Auf der Suche nach der verlorenen Zeit.
Yeah, genau.
Songs itself a perfect form of a time capsule, because when I think of, I also have been or was a songwriter in a band for about 10 years, and when I think of a year, and then I think about a song I've written in this year or an album we made together, then I have a feeling for this certain moment.
Yes.
Songwriting, yes. A perfect thing to get structure or a feeling for time that has passed.
No, I agree. It's like I can remember rooms, I can remember houses, only because I wrote a song there. And in that moment, that song, sitting there writing that song, on a chair, or on a bed, and suddenly I remember the room, and I can't remember the room in any other way. Except I wrote a song there. And it's like when I write a song in a place, it's almost like I'm taking a photo of the place, you know, and or I'll sometimes I've written songs at the beach, you know, like I come back from a swimming in the ocean, and then I come back and I might sit on the veranda and I'll play guitar and I'll write a song, and I remember that veranda, I remember that day, but I don't remember anything else about the holiday. So it really, because I only write one or two, three songs a year, they really, I remember, and when I play songs, I remember where I wrote them, you know, like I and it is going back, you know, like I can sort of, they really mark time and mark place really, really clearly. Like nothing else I know is writing a song.
Do you have an explanation for that?
No, I don't. I don't. I sort of can go on a holiday. I can remember where I was when I wrote a lot of songs, mainly important songs, but I can remember sitting down and doing it, and I can't remember anything else of that day. I can't remember. I remember writing Here Comes the City. I can remember writing Surfing Magazines. I know the room. I know where I was. And I can remember my fingers playing this music for the first time. And it's very strange. It's beautiful. It's beautiful. But I can't explain it.
So you have to work a lot on a song until.
Every day. Like you have to be playing guitar, and you can play guitar every day for 6 months and you get nothing. And then suddenly, you know, and you think it's over. You think I've finished. I'm not going to write any more songs. And then suddenly you write something and you just know. But you have to do that for 6 months. You know, like the most songs I've written over the, you know, if I write three or four songs a year, I'm doing really well. But I've got to try all the time. You know, it takes me 3 or 4 or 5 years to write an album, but I'm trying all the time. And that's just the way that it is. It's been like that since the early 80s or the mid 80s. I write 2 or 3 songs a year.
So you also try today to write a song?
Most days, yeah. I play guitar, and I normally nothing happens. It's okay. It might be an okay thing, but it's not, wow, it's not, that's what I want. I want something new and exciting.
So you were, and today you were also working on a song, or today did you have a day off?
Today I had a day off.
Okay.
Christian. But my life has changed also, because what happened is in 2005, I became a music journalist and a music critic, and then I started to write books, and I'm a writer now, so I'm doing two things. From when the Go-Between started in 1978 until 2005, I was just a songwriter. And then I became an author, writer, you know, like, and I thought that my songwriting would stop, you know, or I'd write less, but it's actually good. You know, like I work between the two, you know, like I'll write, and then I probably play guitar less now. But I'm still getting the same amount of songs. I think it's because I've taken the pressure off myself. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I write other things. And suddenly songwriting's not everything. And that's fantastic, because it's not, you've got to write a song. You've got to write a song. It's like I'll write for a couple of hours, you know, like up, you know, at my desk. And then I'll just go over and pick up the guitar and just play a little bit of guitar. And sometimes something happens, you know. I'm still writing songs I love.
Central, here comes the city. And why do people who read Dostoevsky look like Dostoevsky? A crowded train, a silent night. The country is black and the cities are bright. Here comes the city.
think you really had a songwriter block in the mid-90s. Is that true?
Yes, I did.
You made a record with covers?
Yes.
How did you get over it?
Well, that's a good question. I was in the studio, and there was a lot of musicians in the studio, and one thing happened was we did a little bit of recording with just three people. It was like bass, drums, and me on acoustic on guitar. And suddenly all the other musicians went, and my previous album, Calling From a Country Phone, had four people and other people, and suddenly it was just these three people in this recording studio, and I loved the sound. I knew, wow, I don't need everyone else. I just need a bass player, a drummer, and me, and take everything away. And then I started to think, and when I went back to Brisbane, I just got a drummer I was playing with, and I found Adele, the bass player. And I just went, we're just going to play two chords. And we just started to play very simple. And I just started again. It was like I just broke it all down. You know, like I just made it very comfortable and small. And it was almost like going back to the start of the Go-Betweens, because that's what the start of the Go-Betweens was. Grant and I started the band as a two-piece. And then we had various drummers. But we were just this three-piece. It's almost like I'd forgotten that. But I had to be in that studio with all these people, and then it was just the three of us for a minute, and I went, there's the sound. And that was the start of it. And I started to write song.
So you needed this moment of reduction to...
Yes, of reduction, a moment of reduction. That's very good. Mm. And as soon as I reduced it, I realized that I'd go even further and I'd make the songs really simpler. And I started to write really just simple songs, a lot more rhythm, as opposed to five people playing with all these parts. I started to write these songs that were a little bit more just rhythmic and two or three chords. And suddenly I started to write songs again. After 2.5 years, I didn't write anything for 2.5 years. Mm-hmm. I thought it was over. I was writing things, but I didn't think they're any good. And then I started to write good things.
Do you have a box of drafts for maybe songs in the future?
Yeah, I've got some on my phone, but really everything I write, I pretty much record. It's really strange. But that's the thing. I'm not a normal musician. You know, like I'm sort of I can play guitar and I can write my kind of songs. But I'm not someone like Springsteen or Paul McCartney or, you know, these people that can, you know, like a little bit of bass and then piano and then, you know, guitar and then go and play some drums. I can't do that. All I can do is just, and I came from a time of like post-punk, and punk, but more post-punk in the late 70s, early 80s, where it was a lot more about ideas and not so much, you know, like being a virtuoso musician. And I'm still a little bit of a primitive musician.
Yeah, but that's a bit of an understatement because the longer we were hearing the songs, and we've been listening to this in the last weeks, there are some things which do not strike you at first glance or at first listening, but if you listen more often, you get the idea. So we were talking about the way you are writing or were writing a reference or the chorus, because there's something special to it, because almost nobody we know reduces the choruses that much. Lucas, you told me, maybe you can.
I thought about it because when you hear songs from the Go-Between area, there's always the Grant McLennan songs, and I think they have these long choruses, like, for example, No Reason to Cry or something like that. That's a big
chorus. Yeah.
And some of your songs, I feel that there is a chorus, but just musically, there is nearly no melody. Okay. For example, I mean, it's positive, for sure. For example, Darlinghurst Nights. It's just a progression of chords, and then you sing always the traffic, always the lights.
Yeah,
and that's that. These are the words that stick in my mind.
Yeah.
Do you have what's the mystery behind these songs?
Or are you aware that many songs do not have a chorus?
Yeah, I am. I do, and I worry about it because I think I should write more choruses. But it's just the way that I am. I do like big choruses in other people, and I try to write them myself, but it just doesn't seem to be my style. It just I don't know why. I find it a bit too, you know, like I hear big choruses and I just go, they're very predictable. You know, like I love like Ray Davies. I love, you know, Benny Bjorn from ABBA. I love all of that. But I'm a bit suspicious about big choruses. I find, you know, I listen to things like, you know, especially English group, you know, like Oasis. I just find it, or Queen, you know, the band Queen. I just find it like this, you know, too much. Yeah, I don't know. It's just not my. I'm very aware of this. I know exactly what you're talking about.
Gut rot cappuccino, gut rot spaghetti. Gut rot rock and roll through the eyes of Frank Bernetti. And always the traffic, always the lights. Joe played the cello through those Darlinghurst nights. Always the traffic, always the lights.
I must say, I do like choruses. So it's not like I'm against them, right? I do like choruses, and I have written some, but it's not something that's a big part of my... Grant could do it. Grant could do that very, very well. And that was one of his strengths. That's what he could do. But... And I could do it occasionally, but I don't know. There's lots and lots of people writing big choruses, and so I'm happy to let them do that. And but it means that, you know, like no one's really, you know, covering my songs and they're in the top 40. I mean, I've got to admit that. You know, like I do think that I've written some commercial songs.
Are there any cover versions of songs of yours which you like?
Like a band called the Wannadies from Sweden, from Stockholm. They did a cover of Lee Remick back in the 90s that's very good, like a power pop version that's really good.
Picture my own, she's very beautiful. I come from Brisbane, but I'm quite plain. She's from the mountains, so close to heaven. Skies on her shoes and stars on her chest. I love you, really. She's a darling. I love you, really. She's a darling. She's in the Omen with Gregory Peck. She got killed, what the heck? Her eyes are like gems. She's an actress of screen gems. I love you, really. She's a darling. I love you, really. She's a darling. not died. If I touched her, I'd not wanna cry. My life is desperation, but it's only infatuation. I love you, Remy. She's a darling.
Are there any German-speaking bands you like?
I used to like FSK. They're from Munich. I like some of, like Can and stuff like that. Like everyone likes that, like Can and Kraftwerk and a band you probably haven't heard of called Spari Funkel, who came out of Munich. They're a hippie band in the 70s, and they made two albums that are great. Spari Funkel, I don't know, I learned about them when I was living in Bavaria, and they made two unbelievably good records. But no one knows them outside of Germany, really.
Du liegst im Bett und denkst nix besser, da leid's an deiner Tier. Du reibst den Schlaf aus deine Augen, es ist 4 in der Früh. Draußen stehen's auf dem Gang, du weißt gleich, um was geht. Und du weißt, wann's jetzt nicht aufmachst, ist für dich alles spät. Draußen stehen die Kriminaler und die Suche, was bei dir, und die Suche immer irgendwas und dann alle Lieben in der Früh.
I want to ask you one more time about the lyrics, because on the new album Barbaries, you said the songs are not about you. It's storytelling.
Yeah.
When we listen carefully, there something happens. For example, there's a song called Such a Shame.
Yeah.
And, you sing, for example, you sing about a musician who is on tour, and then he comes back and he's empty.
Yeah.
That's the story behind it. And then you sing, you can look into a mirror, you don't recognize yourself, so you keep on going as somebody else. And that's a very interesting sentence, very interesting lyrics. But what's happening here? Because if you have these kind of thoughts, it seems to be an experience, or it seems like something you have been through, you as Robert Foster.
That's true.
Do you mix up songwriting and your own experiences?
Yes. Yeah, I do it a lot. That line there, those lines that you said, is very much a picture of myself, like when I was in my late 20s and around the age of 30. That was sort of wilder years that I had as a person, that is directly from that experience. But what I like about this album is that there was so much I'm doing this, I'm doing that with my songwriting over the last 3 or 4 albums, which I really like, but I sort of had to discover a new way of writing, and I started to tell these stories, and I discovered, which is an easy thing to discover, you can start to put things into the stories that are very personal, but then you're not in it. Tell it back to me, the first song about that romance between that man and that woman. There's little bits of biography from me in there, but not much, but a little bit. But it's just something I can put in to the story, but the story is still not about me, It's just a nice thing that I'm finding, that I'm discovering, that I can. It's a good way of doing it. I've written one song since I've done the Strawberries album, and it's very much like this as well. It's something that it's going on. It's telling a story, but because I pick up all the details in the story, you know, like where it's set, what people say. That's autobiographical in a way, but because I'm making all the choices, you know, like it's my decisions. Mm-hmm. But it just gives me a little bit more, I can be in the background more. It's and it feels like it's something new, which I like, you know, a new way of writing.
Do you also have sometimes just one line where you say, or two lines where you say they are perfect and you write them down in your notebook and you see that maybe these two lines will not make a song of their own, but maybe I'll write a song once where I can put these two lines in?
So yes, yeah, yeah. That happens a lot, and also with song titles. So when I have a diary, I have diaries, you know, that with, you know, like, I like workbook diaries, and I'm filling them up all the time. About once a year, I get a new diary, and I have song titles and lyric ideas that, or poetry ideas. And so when I write a song, I've got ideas ready.
It soon started an emptiness in her and me. The finer things weren't so fine. We met again through a friend who told us to start again, to try again. Tell me what you see. Tell me what you see. Tell it back to me. You see, tell me what you see, tell me what you see, tell it back to me, tell it back to me.
And also on the song, Such a Shame, you write about a conversation between a musician and his agent.
Yeah.
And, there is the moment the agent, he wants the singer, the musicians to sing more hits or to play more hits.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And don't know if it's about you or not, but in the end, I've also sometimes something going on with set lists.
Yeah.
I'm a big Rolling Stones fan, but I don't really enjoy some of the concerts because they only play the hits. And
yeah, yeah.
I was at the Björk concert and I was a little bit enttäuscht, a little bit
disappointed.
Because I didn't know a single song. She only played the new stuff.
Who's this?
Björk.
Björk. Okay.
She didn't play one song. One single song I knew. What's the perfect set list for you? Is it a mixture of old songs, hits and new songs?
Yeah.
Do you change the set lists often? Or?
Yeah. Well, I don't have any real hits, but I like to do a mixture, you know, like because to me, you know, like it's all in a way one thing. Do you know what I mean? Like it's not like I've made this big style change anywhere. I'm still basically sitting down and writing songs the same way I did in 1977. Do you know what I mean? I haven't got rhythm machines. I haven't got Moog synthesizers or, you know, like, and maybe that's a bad thing, but I'm still sort of, so to me, the songs that I'm writing now on Strawberries in a way go all the way back to the way that I've done things. So to me, everything I've done, I might have written 300 songs. I don't know that have been recorded, and I always like to play new things, you know, that I've, you know, that like off the new album, and but I sort of like a mixture is what I like to do. I think on this tour, I'm going to play the whole album. Like, because I love Strawberries so much, and I haven't done that for a long time. But I'm working on a set list now, and I want to. But then, you know, like I'll be playing songs from the Go-Betweens as well. I can see certain things. There's certain eras that I'm doing. There's like three or four songs from 16 Lovers Lane, for example, that I want to do. And there's like virtually nothing from the 90s, some stuff from the last three Go-Betweens records, some stuff, you know, like a couple of songs off The Candle in the Flame, you know, from Songs to Play, you know, like it is a mixture, but it's going to be about half the concert's going to be my last two albums. But I couldn't do what Bjork did. I think that's taking it too far. But then that's just my thing. You know, like that's I think Bjork's taking it too far and in one way, and I think the Rolling Stones do it too much in the other way. Do you know what I mean? I'm in the middle of Bjork and the Rolling Stones. Okay.
I guess your concert will be 20 or 25 songs maybe, and you will practice them, I guess, with the three men from Sweden. Will there be, do you have something in Germany, we would say, in Austria, would say, in petto? So are you practicing 40 or 50 songs and you could change something spontaneously each evening? Or will it just have some stable set list, which will be it?
I think it'll be stable. I'm thinking that I might do one song where it's just me, and I might change that a lot every night almost. You know, play one song that's just I feel like playing. There'll be a couple of changes. I think that is good. But ciao. I think the set list will be fairly stable, you know. But I think the performances might be quite different every night. You know, like just the way that I know that it's like at the Accent Theater is different to Knust in Hamburg. It's the venues that change. It's the people that change. So you can play the same songs in Vienna and then play them in Manchester, and it's all different. It's all different.
Breakfast on the Train. When I open it on my smartphone, there is this E, which stands for explicit lyrics.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Sure.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, it is.
I didn't know that. Well, I mean, I think that's good. I think that is that I'm happy that there's some warnings on some of my songs.
They made love quickly once. They made love slowly twice. They made love quickly once. Oh yeah. Oh yeah. There was a family in the room next door. They were woken by the banging and the roar. They phoned reception to complain. Reception said, over the volume of love, we have no claim. Fuck is what she said as she jumped up out of their bed. My train is the 904. They got dressed, rushed through the door. Her train, the 904. Oh yeah.
Did you start becoming a music critic in 2005 or 6?
Yeah.
And they are compiled in a book called The 10 Rules of Rock and Roll. And this book is starting with the 10 rules of rock and roll. Don't know if you want to go back to this, or if this is something what you said. Okay, this this is 18 years ago and of no further interest for me. But because I was wondering a lot about some of these rules in the last years or maybe decades. And because there is one rule, you said the second last song on every album is the weakest.
Yeah.
And so I was thinking, is this true? As Lucas mentioned, we have a band and I fully agree. We always put the worst songs at the second last. This is a fact. But there are also some songs like Wish You Were Here from Pink Floyd or Dancing in the Dark from Springsteen or Rebellion from Arcade Fire or Bohemian Rhapsody from Queen. Psycho Killer.
Yep.
As a second to last song, There Is a Light That Never Goes Out from the Smiths. So there are also actually very good songs.
I mean, normally when you're sequencing like an album, there's certain things that you've got to do. So you've got to start with a bang. You know, like it's got to be a very, very good, confident start. Even if it's a ballad or a rock song, you've the first couple of songs would go bang. And then at the end of side one, you've got to go bang because you want people to turn the record over. And then side two, you've got to start with something strong and you've got to end the record with something strong, a big song to end the record. So if you want to sneak, put that one song in that's not great, the logical place to put it is right at the end. So people have listened to all the songs. They know there's going to be a big last song. And so that little space there is where you put your weakest song. And that's just the way it's from the form of an album, you know, like strong start, side one, make people turn over, big bang, side two, end the album with a big ballad or something. And then you just sneak in that weak song right there.
And then is this rule which really puzzled me, because you wrote that great bands tend to look alike.
Yes.
But this is pretty much exactly the opposite of what you were doing your whole life, because you always tried to have women in the bands or some kind of age differences in the band. So your bands were almost always the opposite of coherent.
That's true. But I think what I was thinking about is like what happens with bands, okay? And this is not famous bands. This is bands that spend a lot of time together, because bands, especially if you're touring, you know, you don't have to be a big successful band, but if you're touring and you're in the rehearsal room and you're in the recording studio, you're spending a lot of time together. And because you're spending a lot of time together, you start to dress alike. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And so you might be all together, you know, four or five people, say guys, say men. And then one day someone walks into the studio with a beard, say a beard, right? What'll happen is 2 days later, one other member of the band will start to grow a beard. And then in 2 months, everyone in the band has a beard. And it's not because anyone talks about it. It's because you're spending so much time together. It's human nature. It's human behavior. You start to dress and look like your little, like families. Families look the same because they're all always together. And it's the same with bands. Do you know what I mean? You know, you too. They all look alike. The Cure, they all look alike. Joy Division, they all looked alike. The Beatles, every year, they looked the same, even though they were changing really quickly. It's because they're with each other all the time.
You try to avoid it.
I don't know if we tried to avoid it. I think sometimes we looked, like if you've got women in the band, then that complicates things because everyone, you know, like you've got two different dressing styles.
There's still one rule which I'm wondering about. Is that that a three-piece band is the purest form of rock and roll expression. Obviously, you were talking about your own experiences. What are other bands you were thinking about, or are these just about your own experiences?
No, it's about other bands as well. I think with a three-piece band, and we're talking mainly drums, bass, and guitar, there's no one playing rhythm, right? You know, like there's no one on keyboards, you know, putting it all together, you know, like, or a rhythm guitar player. It's like when there's just bass, drums, and guitar, basically everyone sort of soloing. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And that is to me, there's just something very pure about that. And to me, it's like, it goes back to, say, Buddy Holly and the Crickets. Mm-hmm. You know, like, you know, it goes back to Elvis, you know, before, you know, it was Scotty Moore, Bill Black on bass, and Elvis was basically the rhythm guitar player. Everyone was just doing one thing. No one was doing two things. It's the same with, say, a band like Cream. It's the same with Nirvana. Mm-hmm. It's just like there's nowhere to hide. It's just like there's no one, there's not a fourth person who's bringing it all together like that. It's just like one, two, three. And I find that the purest form of rock and roll. I just find that it's completely free.
Okay, so these were the three rules which I was wondering the most in the last year. So all questions answered in this regard. Lucas, you still have a question?
Yes, one more question. I thought about the big benefits of being a songwriter or writing a song. Mm-hmm. And I think that one of the biggest benefits is to create something that lasts forever. So it's be a victory over time. Do you agree?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I really do. I think, especially if you record them, I think that there is something magic about the recording process, and then that means that moment is there forever. I agree with you. I songs can never be taken away. You know, they exist. I agree with you. I think that's a very, very wise thing to say. And I think it's probably a reason why I make records, because I think that they mightn't sell a million copies, or they, you know, I mightn't be playing in a stadium, but I've got this body of work that is recorded, that exists. And whatever happens to it, I don't know. But I'm very happy that it is there, and maybe some things will last into the future, you know. I hope so, but I can't tell. Yeah.
This is a fine, nice ending.
Vielen Dank, and for the Fragen und alles, es ist sehr gut. And so we'll see each other in Wien, and that'll be good. Matt, bis bald. Vielen Dank.
Vielen Dank.
Okay. Thank you for the questions, and I really appreciate it. Wonderful talking to you.
We used to get our kicks reading surfing magazines. Wake up in the morning and the waves are clean. Standing on the headland, taking in the scene. Just like they do it. Surfing magazines. Surfing magazines. Surfing magazines. Surfing magazines. Surfing magazines. Pipeline and Gary.
Surfing Magazine.